Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we are going to talk about spies this hour of the show. The American recently accused of being a spy is coming in from the cold. It's a very bizarre story. 5 days after Russia ordered him to leave, he was spotted at a Moscow airport going through passport control and security. And his name is Ryan Fogel. He had some strange wigs, and the Russian newspapers played this story up in a huge way. There is some question as to whether or not he was really a spy or the Russians really set this whole thing up. Well, it got us thinking, and it got the Daily Beast, actually, thinking about some of the more compelling spy cases in history. So we thought, hey, let's do a show on spies and spy equipment and some of the more famous spies in history. And that's what we're going to do this hour of the show. It should be a fascinating hour. Peter Ernest is joining us. I've never been to this museum, but the next time I'm in D.C., I'll be there. He's executive director of the International Spy Museum. He had a 36-year career with the CIA, including over 20 years in the agency's clandestine service. He's a member of the CIA's Senior Intelligence Service and was awarded the agency's Intelligence Medal of Merit for superior performance. He also served as the agency's principal spokesperson in his final posting, developing and implementing a strategy of greater openness with the media and the public. Peter, thank you so much for being with us. This is going to be so interesting. I got to go to your museum.
Okay, glad to be with you.
Thank you, Peter, very much for your call, for being with us. And we'll invite calls in a moment. Caitlin Dixon is also with us. She's a reporter with the Daily Beast, and the Daily Beast actually prompted this show because they did that recent story that she wrote on the 10 most famous spy cases in the history of espionage. Caitlin, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you with us. Peter, let's start with you. Were you a spy?
I think you would have to say so. I was sent abroad by my government to collect intelligence using the means of espionage. So, yes, I would fall under that category.
And when did you
Although I would say this, that those of us who were in that discipline, if you will, we considered the foreign sources who cooperated with us the real spies. They were the ones taking the risks.
Right. Well, you probably took a fair number yourself. What years were you most active doing this? What were you working on, if you can be open about that?
Well, during the 60s and early 70s.
Uh-huh.
Well, now, you're talking about, I mean, I stayed in operations, but those were the periods when I was in the field the most.
Was this something you wanted to do ever since you were a child? I mean, there aren't many people who do this as in terms of making a living, are there? It fascinates all of us.
Not that I know of. It wouldn't have occurred to me. When I was young, I had everybody sort of has something they're interested in. I had about a 10-foot shelf on the FBI. That interests me. Then, of course, when I grew up, there was no CIA. I mean, there was none for a while. It started in 1947. And even when it started up, there was very, very little public information about it. There weren't all the books and movies and television and so forth.
Right. Caitlin, let's ask you what prompted this most interesting spy cases in history. And I also want to know what you think of this. It's kind of a story within a story, this whole Fogel. I don't know what the heck is going on with that story, if indeed he was a spy or the Russians just made a big deal over this for some reason. It's a fascinating story within a story, isn't it?
It is.
Well, it is,
yeah,
and I think it's quite clear that the arrest and publicizing it of that incident with Ryan Fogel was clearly a setup by the Russians. Now, it raises the question of whether Fogel was involved in something and the Russians got onto it and then either turned whoever he was talking to or simply decided to wrap it up, or, which is quite possible, it was what we would call a sting operation. That is, did they put someone in the way hoping that the Americans would nibble? And we have no idea. We know no details.
Mm-hmm.
All we saw were the photographs of of Fogel being apprehended, lying on the ground, and then, of course, sitting at a desk in FSB headquarters with some paraphernalia in front of it.
Yeah. How do you, as a reporter, Caitlin, figure out what happened there?
I mean, we're just trying to find, you know, follow the information that's coming out of Russia and, you know, trying to look carefully at everything that we're reading and hearing about him and, you know, try to discern what's true and what might be a setup. But it is kind of a mysterious story and obviously very interesting to watch unravel.
Yeah.
With regards to your other question, we just, you know, spies have always been fascinating and kind of, you know, something that I think everyone is interested in, and that's why after the story about Ryan Fogel being arrested came out, we decided to, you know, take a look back at some of the more famous cases of arrested spies in history, because obviously, you know, there have been many more that weren't caught and arrested that we probably don't even know about.
Yeah. The history, and you find this in the museum, goes way back. You have some artifacts that go back to George Washington, don't you? Peter?
Well, spying has been with us since recorded history, and obviously before that. What is it called? The second oldest profession, I think. So there's nothing new about spying. There's nothing new about the relations between states, including spies being sent out from both of them to spy on the other one. So it's not a new phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the Cold War may have ended in 1991, spying didn't.
How do you learn the trade? How do you learn to become a spy? How do you learn all the equipment and all the contacts and what precautions to take and how to keep yourself out of danger?
Well, I think it's a combination of training and experience. I would say that's true of whether you're studying to be an FBI special agent or a diplomat or a medical doctor. I mean, typically, most folks go through some periods of training. And then, of course, the most valuable training of all is having the actual experience.
Mm-hmm. Caitlin, what do you think of all the stories that you reported on? What were the most interesting, compelling spy cases that you put in the magazine online?
Well, I think that, you know, there was the story of Boris Yuzin I found pretty interesting. He was actually sent by the Russians to spy on the U.S., and then once he got to the U.S., you know, felt at home there and decided to switch sides and started giving the U.S. information on Russia. I found that one to be particularly interesting. And then there's the story of Harold Nicholson, who was a former American CIA agent who was convicted in 1997 for selling U.S. intelligence to the Russians, and didn't stop being a spy once he was already in prison. He actually had his son transfer information for money for him while he was in jail, and then the two of them, you know, got arrested, and he had even more years added onto his sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like Peter mentioned, what's interesting is that, you know, the Cold War has ended, but, you know, spying, especially between Russia and the U.S., has not ended. And I think probably the most famous case of recent history is that of Anna Chapman, the young
yes.
redheaded woman who was arrested just a few years ago for leading a spy ring. And, you know, she was actually sent back to Russia in 2010 in a prisoner exchange and is now, you know, last we checked, living as a TV star and a model in Moscow.
Yeah, that received a lot of attention because she
yeah.
was very young and very beautiful, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about you, Peter?
Yeah, I think she was striking. I don't know if I would call her beautiful.
Okay. But the story was an interesting one. Do you want to add to that or comment on any of the ones
well,
that Caitlin...
Well, what I would say is that was an extraordinary situation in that for the Russians to keep virtually a team of illegals, that's what we call them, in this country for 10 years is a huge investment of money
mm-hmm.
and training and personnel. And, of course, we now know that the FBI had them under surveillance for 10 years. So it was quite extraordinary. We had never seen so many of, again, what we call illegals, people living under other names, raising families and so forth. We had never seen a sort of a cluster of them here for so long. Typically, they're sent out in sort of onesies and twosies and held as sleeper agents, and then they're assigned to carry out very sensitive tasks. This was very unusual. And, of course, we rounded them up and paraded them before the courts, had them declare their real names and so forth. So it's conceivable that Fogel is a bit of a payback for that, although that happened in 2010.
Hmm.
And the other thing I would add, as you know, we traded those 10 illegals for four Russians who allegedly had been spying on our behalf. So it just reminds me of the Department of Agriculture program with fish, you know, the catch and release program. So you sort of catch them and then you send them back.
Right.
So you may see that being played out here in the case of young Mr. Fogel.
Yeah. Tell me what indeed might be going on because of the Marathon bombing case. There is an interest in the Russians want us to find out a lot more about this movement in Chechnya. There was word today. This caught my attention on the news in Orlando, Florida, early Wednesday, an FBI agent was involved in a deadly shooting connected to the Boston Marathon bombing case. NBC is reporting the agent is dead. There's obviously a lot going on as a result of that. And I'm wondering, is there Russian-U.S. cooperation here? Was this whole blowing up on Russian TV of this possible American spy somehow related to investigations of Chechnya or what? Peter?
Yeah, no, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, yeah, that's it. There's just so much going on here. I'm wondering about all of that.
Well, I think there is a lot going on, and as I indicated there, you have relations between states, in this case the United States and Russia, and we are cooperating in some areas. Certainly Secretary of State Kerry has been talking to the Russians about some form of cooperation in the case of Syria and perhaps Iran. You had the Russians apparently had given us a heads up on Mr. Tsareyev as possibly being an extremist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's all the information. I think the FBI went back, or the CIA went back to see if there was anything more, but I don't think there was anything more. But you have, think of compartments. In other words, you have a compartment over here where there is a form of cooperation, perhaps on terrorism, illegal activities, and yet we're also competitive in many other ways, whether it's commercially or in the diplomatic field.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk to you just a little bit more, Caitlin, about some of these other spy stories, and then we want to welcome some phone calls. I don't know if you've mentioned Jonathan Pollard, but that certainly was a fascinating case that went on for quite some period of time. You highlight him in the magazine.
Yes. He was indeed a fascinating case. I mean, a lot of these stories that we focused on, you know, dealt with spying for the Soviet Union, but he was a spy for Israel. And Jonathan Pollard was raised in America to a Jewish family in the Midwest, had always kind of felt out of place and had felt an alliance to the state of Israel more so than the U.S., it seems. And he, you know, had kind of had an interesting story. People after he was arrested, who knew him, you know, recalled that he would make up kind of these extravagant stories about, you know, being with the IDF or the Israeli version of the CIA that, you know, weren't true. And then he ended up being able to spy for them for quite a long time. And he is still in prison, and pretty much every president in recent history has been petitioned to pardon him. And most recently, you know, Obama made clear that, you know, he has no plans to release him, but that he will, you know, receive the same review and treatment as any other prisoner, despite the fact that, you know, we have such close relations with Israel and that Israel has, you know, made clear that they would like him to be released.
Peter, you were going to comment?
No, I just want to say I'm on a cell phone, and I don't get the best reception here of either you or your reporter.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So I'm trying to follow along, and I know You were talking about the Pollard case.
Yes.
And, of course, Pollard was sort of a strange individual. He offered to spy for all sorts of people before the Israelis took him up on it. So it has a very checkered history. And
right.
As your reporter may have said, you know, there have been efforts by the Israelis finally admitted that he had provided them information. I don't think they've ever told us precisely what he provided. But, you know, there have been efforts by the Israelis to see if they could get him free. Mm-hmm. But I'm sorry, I couldn't. I really had trouble hearing the other half of the conversation there.
Okay, well, we heard both of you, so we're okay. You may not be okay with all, but we're okay. We've got it. Ethel and Julius Rosenberg's certainly a story that to some people seems unresolved. Peter, do you think it's still a great mystery as to whether or not they were spies?
I think it's totally resolved.
Do you?
There were people who, there was, of course, a public clamor, and I think they're the only people we've executed, civilians we've executed for espionage in this country. But there were critics who said, I won't believe they spied until I hear from the KGB officer who handled them. Well, the KGB officer who handled them was a fellow named Feklasov. And he did a book because they're regarded as heroes in the then Soviet Union. And so he both visited this country. He wrote a book in praise of them. Like other people who've spied for the Soviet Union, there was a stamp made there in their honor. And we know of at least 50 that's 50 meetings that took place in New York between Rosenberg and his KGB handler. And he gave away quite a bit of information about military technology, including the proximity fuse, which is probably what brought down Francis Gary Powers, the U-2 pilot, in 1960.
Mm-hmm.
So there's absolutely no question about the Rosenbergs.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of Francis Gary Powers, what do you have in the museum? There was something that was captured or retrieved from the wreckage.
I have visited the museum in Moscow, and the KGB has a fair amount. They have a whole little display case showing material from the wreckage. So we don't have anything from the wreckage here. We have. I think one of the things we have is a replica of what he was given, which he could use to take his own life if he was captured.
Oh.
Yeah. But I think the wreckage is still in the hands of where he crashed. That is in Russia.
Uh huh. Did you ever carry something that you could use to take your own life?
No. Unless I was to try and do myself in with my fountain pen.
Huh. Let's welcome phone calls. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Caitlin, we just will give you a final chance here because our other guest can't hear you and we want to talk to him about spying. Are there other people that we missed on your list of the 10 most interesting spy cases that we should be sure and talk about before we carry on?
Go ahead, Peter.
No, I'm just going to you, Caitlin, before we have to say goodbye to you.
Oh, okay. I mean, I think we touched on the most interesting ones, but I think also Aldrich Ames was one of the more interesting ones that I think that I wrote about. He had been in the CIA for 31 years, and his fall kind of took down a whole wake of other spies. He also had an interesting story, which I'm sure Peter probably knows more about than I do, but, you know, he was kind of notoriously not good at his job of recruiting other officers and often passed over for promotions and, you know, had somewhat of a drinking problem that kind of led to his interest in spying for the Russians. He was accused of spying since 1985 when he was arrested in 1994, and his wife was also arrested for aiding and abetting his activities. And he was sentenced to life in prison, and she was sentenced to 63 months.
Caitlin, thank you so much. I'm so glad you picked up on the story and you got us interested in doing this hour, so thank you.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Our pleasure. Caitlin Dixon from the Daily Beast. Peter Ernest is continuing with us, executive director of the International Spy Museum in D.C., and what a life he's had, a 36-year CIA career, including over 20 years in the agency's clandestine service, a member of the CIA's senior intelligence service. Two phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
So what do you know about Yanis?
Zilch. Zips.
No one's ever seen him.
But the man's connected up the gazoo. KGB, military, screwdriver.
Rumor has it he lives on one of those old Soviet missile trains. That armor stuff they used to run around the country so we couldn't target him.
Want to hand me that hammer, Jimbo? No, the bigger one, the sledge. Anyways, to tell the truth, you don't find this guy, he finds you. Hell, it's all Russian mafia. The best thing I can do is point you in the direction of his competition.
Who is the competition?
Hot ex-KGB guy. Tough mother. Got a limp on his right leg. Name's Sukovsky.
Valentin Dmitrovich Sukovsky?
Yeah. You know him?
I gave him the limp.
From the James Bond movie GoldenEye in 1995. We'll talk about Peter's picks for the best spy movies as well. Here's how you can join our conversation. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Let's go to Chris in Milwaukee, our first caller for you, Peter. Hello, Chris.
During the late 20th century, I read a mainstream newspaper report in which an unnamed, shadowed Soviet citizen claimed that there was an unused plot or capability to sabotage one of the Apollo lunar missions. I've always been skeptical of this claim for one reason. I own many books on the history of NASA. I've never read anything about this. Two questions for Peter. Do you know of any plot during the 20th century in which a Russian agent's job was to sabotage one of the lunar missions? And this, of course, would have been a plot that was never implemented. And secondly, more broadly, Peter, do you know of multiple examples where former Soviet citizens came here, made wild claims for the purpose of generating income, perhaps through book sales or the lecture circuit?
Peter.
Oh, yeah, I'm here.
Did you hear that, Peter?
Yes, I could hear the questions. My answer to the first question is no, I have never heard of that case. Keep in mind, I'm not a historian. I'm a director of a museum here. No, I've never heard of that. The other question was, am I aware of people coming here, Soviets coming here, or people coming out of the Soviet Union to write books to make money? I think everyone who writes books are writing them to make money, by and large. It's very hard to say, you know, was someone writing it to make money? Yes, I think that a number of the Soviets thought that their stories were of interest, particularly those who had been in the intelligence services and thought that they had stories that would be of interest. I'm not aware of that as being some sort of propaganda ploy or anything. I think that those would have been individual actions.
Peter, have you seen the TV show The Americans? I'm hooked on it now.
I've seen part of it, yes.
Yeah, it's a very interesting premise and I think extremely well done. Do you have...
It's well done from the point of view of doing a TV show.
Yes, yes.
It is nothing like, in other words, and some of the tradecraft or spycraft is interesting, but no illegals. Those folks on there are illegals in much the same way that the 10 I referred to earlier were illegals. But no illegals that I have ever heard of would have been carrying out so many different tasks on behalf of the Soviet intelligence, Russian intelligence.
Yeah, it just as a TV show, I think it's fascinating.
It's a good TV show.
Right. Are there? Do you like the Bond films? Are there other, do you like John Le Carré? Are there other spy novelists or TV makers or filmmakers who you think are pretty darn good?
Well, I think the Bond series is fascinating. You touch on an interesting point. We have just opened, over the holidays in December, we have just opened a major James Bond exhibit in our museum here in Washington. Yes, this was on the occasion of the 23rd film by Eon Productions, Skyfall. And our exhibit includes over 100 artifacts from Eon Productions from the Bond films. And what we do, we take a very interesting approach. We look at the Bond phenomenon, you know, because he's been so popular. And for many people, he's the image of a spy. And we look at it from the point of view of the villains. What threat do the villains represent? And I think in many cases, the villains represented threats about things that governments and society was apprehensive about, whether it was genocide or nuclear proliferation or whatever. So we've opened the exhibit. It's, people are thoroughly enjoying it. So there's a good chance to put in a good word for the James Bond exhibit. It's called Exquisitely Evil, 50 Years of Bond Villains.
Oh, I want to see it. Chris, thanks for your call. Barb in Sister Bay, hi.
Hi, great show. My question is, does your guest feel that regardless of whether there's a Republican or Democrat in the White House, that the policy for spying for the CIA remains pretty much consistent in the same since its inception? And I'll listen off the air.
All right. Thanks, Barb.
Go ahead.
She's finished, Peter. Did you hear her?
Yeah, I did. Okay. I could not hear that question well, no.
Oh, she wondered if the policy for spying remained pretty much consistent, be it a Republican or a Democratic administration.
Yes, in that the intelligence community, which includes all the agencies, including CIA, is not meant to be partisan. It's not a Republican or a Democratic instrument. Now, any given administration, whether it's Bush in our recent memory or Obama in current memory, they may have their own things that they emphasize or policies that they choose to pursue. I think one example would certainly be the Bush initiatives in going into Iraq and other places. The agency's role, CIA's role, is to support what the president and the policymakers determine, you know, will happen. Right now, certainly the drones being used in Afghanistan and Iraq are being administered largely by the CIA. That again is at the direction of the administration, but the administration has to win the support, whether it's Congress or whoever. The intelligence community is here to serve the country in terms of what it's carrying out.
You talked about interesting spy craft. I'd like for you to concentrate a bit on and tell us about the most important spy craft, that which was invented at some time in history that gleaned more information, valuable information, than anything else.
Well, I would say the human brain has probably conceived of more ways to, to get information than anything else. And most intelligence officers will tell you that. You ask them what's the most important device that you have. It's their own thinking process. You know, but certainly you can go back to World War II and the phenomenon of the folks out at Bletchley Park outside of London managing to break the Enigma code. The Enigma was a code device used by the Germans, which they considered unbreakable. And the fellow who led that effort at Bletchley Park was named Turing. And to do that, he, in effect, created the world's first modern computer. So it was an extraordinary achievement. And it's now been, I think, recognized by Google as a major step in the development of computers. So that was certainly a big one.
Mm-hmm. You also have a device designed by Thomas Jefferson. This guy was truly a Renaissance character, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. You're talking about the little coding device.
Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah. You know, it's very common in that period of history for people to write in codes, knowing that their mail might be intercepted or read by people other than the recipient. And so it was not all that unusual for people to try and have little codes that they use.
Oh, what about you when you were a spy? Did you use a certain code?
Did I use what?
A code.
Well, I was involved with what was, I was part of Soviet East European Division in the agency, and we communicated with our agents, often using things such as a form of open code or even, in some cases, invisible writing.
Hmm.
It sounds very, very old-fashioned, as do some of the devices that were laid out on the table in front of Mr. Fogel, but sometimes the old tradecraft works well. You know, we all now have cell phones with cameras in them. We have laptops and so forth. Those things can be hacked into.
Oh.
And they can betray your location and maybe betray other information about you. And you'll notice even Osama bin Laden, as he went into hiding, knowing that his electronic communications had been overheard, his cell phone and so forth, dropped all electronic communications.
Yes.
He resorted on the most primitive of communications means, and that was a courier, which is precisely how they tracked him.
Yes, and those go way back. There were pigeons, I guess you have these in the museum, with cameras released over military sites in World War I. I wonder if he used any pigeons.
Yes, the pigeons, homing pigeons,
yeah,
for messages goes back to the Romans.
Does it really?
Yes, it does, yeah. People had discovered that phenomenon and the idea of sending messages. And as you say, it was certainly used in World War I.
Yeah. So this idea of putting a little tiny camera behind a button, which was pretty sophisticated when it was used, wouldn't fly now because it could be tracked?
Now, are you talking about on the pigeons?
No, on somebody's suit.
I'm sorry, on what?
On somebody's suit. I think you have in the museum a little tiny camera that people, spies, used. It was behind their buttons.
Oh, yeah. Well, I used one of those. There was actually it was a regular-sized camera that you wore in a harness around your body.
Oh.
What you saw in the museum is an overcoat, which was worn over that, and then the shutter release was in your pocket at the end of a cable, and the lens, which looked like an eye, was hidden behind one of the overcoat buttons.
Weren't you afraid? I can't imagine being decked out like that without worrying that somebody was going to find out about you. I'd be nervous as could be.
Well, that's probably you shouldn't go into the business.
How do you learn to be cool, sir?
Yeah, you learn to handle yourself in situations like that, and you know there always is the apprehension that in some way you may be found out. That's one of the that's part of what goes with the territory, as they say.
Yeah. Let's go back to phone calls. If you have a hard time, I'll just repeat the question so people calling in, he's on a cell phone and it's very clear for us, but he's having a hard time hearing you. I don't want to exclude you, so make your comments as succinct as possible so I can remember what you said. Jack in Eagle River, hi.
Yeah, good morning. Just as in passing, the best spy film that I can recall was The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. It just seemed so real and so grim, and the kind of thing that you would expect.
Let's ask Peter to respond. Did you see The Spy Who Came In From the Cold? Did you like that film?
Yes, I think it was a very good film. And John le Carré is a wonderful writer.
Mm-hmm.
A great way with words. I think the only problem or the issue I would have is that Carré himself was in British intelligence. And he tends to look at both Western intelligence as well as the adversary, and that was the KGB, in almost equal terms, sort of a pox on both your houses. And I think that's unfair, because I think to a great extent Western intelligence, at least in my experience, reflected the values of the country. Now, do sometimes, are there abuses? Did things go wrong? Absolutely. They can go wrong in any pursuit of life. But I think sort of taking sort of a wholesale look, I think, goes a little bit far. Another film that I would recommend to give you a sense of what it's like living in an authoritarian state like East Germany was a movie called Lives of Others.
Mm.
That was extremely well done. Most professional intelligence officers think very highly of it.
Hmm. Jack, you had something else?
Yeah, I wanted to mention that a couple of years ago, my wife and I went to Washington, and we thought we knew everything that was there, but we bumped into the Spy Museum, and what a treat that was. That's the thing we most remember with all the other museums and exhibits. It was so intriguing, and it was just hands-on enough and so on. So I just thought I'd mention that. Anybody that doesn't know about it, like we didn't, try to make that extra time to go there.
Well, I very much appreciate your words of praise, but I would say this, that if you were here a couple of years ago, the Bond exhibit, which I referred to earlier in the broadcast, only went up in December. So I would encourage you to come back and see us again to enjoy that.
Now, is your life boring now compared to the work that you did being a spy? Have you made an adjustment here, okay, Peter?
I'm sorry?
Have you been able to make an adjustment to the life of a museum director without some of the drama of being a spy?
Oh, yes. I mean, I don't... there's a lot of excitement in doing intelligence work. There's a lot of excitement in living undercover and so forth. It can sometimes be a little hard on the family. But no, I think being here, in a sense, has allowed me to keep my hand in, because I'm still dealing with things about intelligence and about espionage. So in some ways, it's as if I never left.
Right. I'll bet it was a little hard on the family. That's probably the understatement of the hour. Who has the best information gathering spy agencies in the world in 2013?
Well, I think it's probably among the most extensive intelligence gathering of the Chinese.
Really?
Their collection of information about the United States through cyber attacks is absolutely extraordinary. The number of secrets that they have stolen from this country, both corporate secrets, technology, military technology, is, I think, if the American people realized the extent of Chinese espionage through cyber, they would be absolutely stunned.
What should we do about that?
Well, we've done some things. There has been the creation of a cyber command, which is now out at Fort Meade, near where the National Security Agency is. It's under the same commander, General Alexander. He commands both the cyber command and the National Security Agency. Recently, the government has revealed that we certainly have developed an offensive capability, as well as simply the capability of defending ourselves. But as far as I'm aware, there has been an extraordinarily huge amount of information, intellectual property, and so forth, already stolen from this country, and certainly the sense is mostly by the Chinese.
Mm. We welcome more phone calls this hour. Our guest is Peter Ernest. He's executive director of the International Spy Museum. More importantly to the conversation that we are having, he was in the CIA for 36 years, 20 years in the agency's clandestine service, and a member of the CIA's Senior Intelligence Service. In other words, a spy. And the reason we wanted to do this show is because, you know, we were following the story with Russian authorities ordering this U.S. embassy employee who they accused of being a CIA spy. He was ordered out of Moscow, out of the country. It was a huge story in the Soviet Union or in Russia, and people were wondering, was this really a setup? What's the real truth of that story? We're not sure, but it got us thinking about spying and the International Spy Museum and spies in history and what spies are doing now, how it's changed, all of that. So we'll take more phone calls in just a moment. We had mentioned John Le Carre. Nancy Pearl, one of our regular guests, loved this movie and the book as well. This is just a little bit from Tinker Tailor's Soldier Spy.
There's a rotten apple, Jim. And we have to find it.
What did you make of it, Jim? Controls theory.
I thought it was madness.
I know that it is one of five men. All I want from you is one code name. Alaline.
From Tinker Tailor's Soldier Spy, which is really an intriguing movie. Peter Ernest is our guest. He's executive director of the International Spy Museum and with us for a couple more minutes. Fred in Liberty, hello.
Hi there. Oh, this is a great topic. I'm loving it. It's so sexy and intriguing, all the intelligence stuff. But I'd kind of like to talk about more the unsavory aspect of intelligence work. It seems like, from my reading and well, with the internet and everything now, everybody seems to be on the level that there's an overt collusion between all intelligence agencies and organized crime the world over. And how these hard drugs come over to our country, it seems like, you know, we have one of our great Wisconsinites, Go Badgers, Eugene Hassenfuss back in the day in the 80s, if you remember back. I think he got shot down by some guys in Central America and he was doing something. And,
right.
Yeah, I don't know. Is there anything in the museum about that?
Collusion between intelligence organizations and organized crime, Peter.
Well, what I would say, what the intelligence community is seeing is that with globalization, certainly since the end of the Cold War in 1991 and globalization that has taken place since then, everything has become globalized.
Hmm.
Whether it's crime, drugs, human trafficking, counterfeiting, terrorism, and so forth, so that these phenomena that often were confined to a state or a specific place have become globalized. And we're also seeing another phenomenon, and that is that a number of terrorist groups are using drugs and drug smuggling to help finance their terrorism activities. So you're seeing trade-offs there. And these are the areas that there has been some international cooperation on because it obviously it's a threat to states all over the world. So, we don't have anything on the specific case the caller referred to, but certainly the organized crime by its very nature it looks for opportunities to, looks for vulnerabilities in anywhere it can to pursue its own aims. And that's something that intelligence increasingly has been asked to report on.
Thanks, Fred. Bruce in Albany. Hi.
Good morning. I was curious as to spy is basically in secret. How can you have an international spy museum? It seems like everybody's sharing what they did to be a spy.
Okay,
now I had trouble hearing that one.
How can you have an international spy museum? Would everybody share what their secrets are to have an international museum?
Well, it's called the International Spy Museum because both through our displays, but particularly through our programs, we make every effort to report to show people things which reflect spying around the world. So there's no, it's not as if there's some cooperation here between different intelligence agents. We are a museum.
Right.
And we have had any number of programs and so forth whether it's about Israeli intelligence, Chinese intelligence, wartime intelligence, Civil War intelligence, all of those activities which were directed at collecting intelligence by different countries are of interest to us as a museum.
Hmm. The British have referred to spying as the great game. I know it's very serious business, but is there also, is it an apt description that it can be an elaborate great game?
The great game, of course, was the whole role of the nations in the same areas now, where in the Middle East, Southeast Asia, so forth, where that was played out as they contended for power. I have heard intelligence referred to as a game simply because people are trying to protect secrets, others are trying to get them. So you have people will liken it to a chess game.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, one move tends to be greeted by another. Think of it as sort of almost like military technology. Somebody develops one weapon, somebody else will develop a way to defend against that, and there's sort of an escalation of capabilities that goes on.
Just one more comment for you. I know you have to leave us. Peter Catherine in Milwaukee said, I wanted to take the opportunity to say what a wonderful experience this museum is. She dragged my reluctant adult daughters who live in D.C. to it a few years ago when I was visiting. Now it is on their must-visit list when friends and relatives are in town.
Thank you. I'm always delighted to hear that.
I'm sure you are. You could hear that all day. Peter, you're really a fascinating person. Thank you so much for being with us.
Okay. Well, it was good to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
Uh-huh. Our pleasure. Peter Ernest, Executive Director of the International Spy Museum. Rhonda collected some clips of spy things, so this is from the movie. Many of you have seen this, I'm sure. That's what we should do this weekend, watch spy movies. Spies Like Us.
These guys are not our legitimate contacts. These guys are KGB Special Branch.
Oh, come on.
Don't tell me to come on. That was a Russian wristwatch. I know the country of origin of every timepiece in the world. That was a Russian copy of a 1969 Timex Digital.
What is this, some kind of a hobby with you?
Basic. Most common slip-up in espionage. We've walked right into enemy hands.
Well, that was fun, wasn't it? The International Spy Museum. Peter Ernest, we thank him for... Thank you for being with us. Executive director of that museum and a former spy for a number of years, worked for the CIA, and the museum is in D.C. Thanks also to, and she got us thinking about this because she wrote a piece about it, the Daily Beast article about the 10 most important spies in history. We thank Caitlin Dixon, reporter and researcher for the Daily Beast, and many thanks to Rhonda Fanning for putting this all together. Well, I want to tell you a little bit about tomorrow, because tomorrow is a special day. Over the years, we have been delighted to do comedy shows, and two of our favorite comedians, great body of work, Bob and Ray. I had a chance to interview Bob, who's 90 years old now, last week, and we're going to be talking with Bob Elliott and also with the author of Bob and Ray Keener. I love this. Oh, I just think about it and I laugh. Keener Than Most Persons. That's the name of the book. We'll speak with the author of that, and we'll hear a little bit of their absolutely classic and witty and creative and smart comedy. That will be for part of tomorrow's program. And also tomorrow, we'll speak with the author of The Guns at Last Light, The War in Western Europe, 1944 to 1945. Mike Simonson will also join us from our bureau in wonderful Superior, Wisconsin. He has done an award-winning program, a documentary following a vet for a number of years, so he will be with us, and we'll play his documentary on Memorial Day. That's all I have to say. Had a lot of fun and some important conversations. I hope you did too. We'll be with you tomorrow.